It's a snowy Friday evening, and dozens have flocked to the Calgary Climbing Center, Rocky Mountain. The music is blasting, and there are people of all ages here, cheering each other on as they scurry up the artificial rack face and rappel down. I'm here to meet Coralia Sevilla. She's a climbing instructor, and tonight, she's hosting an event with the Soul of Mistaki, a group founded by a Blackfoot woman, Cassia Youngman, who's also here tonight. They're here to promote outdoor sports for Indigenous, Black, and racialized communities, as well as foster connection and healing through movement. It's focused on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's Call to Action Number 89, to amend the Physical Activity and Sport Act policy to reduce barriers to sport participation and promote physical activity as a fundamental element of health and well-being. Climbing is more than just climbing for Coralia. It's a way to connect to the land that she lives on, in Calgary, on Treaty 7 territory. She says it's been a big contributor to her role in Truth and Reconciliation as a child of immigrants.
I mean, I climb because I like pushing grades and challenging myself, but there's a spiritual connection in being able to touch the rock or be with people and being outside. And for me, that's the healing part, right? And that is part of Truth and Reconciliation in some way, because we're coming down to the roots of things. We're connecting with communities and spaces and making sure that we're aware of where we are.
Her parents immigrated to Canada from Nicaragua, and Coralia grew up understanding how colonization impacted her people. Working with Soul of Mistaki and having conversations about the land she now calls home helps her better understand the impacts of colonization here.
We just had our sharing circle where we were all just like able to be very vulnerable and share those challenges that we have with our role in society, but also being grateful of having a community that we can rely on and make mistakes in front of and learn from. In school, they're like, this is what happened to them and this is the story. Whereas like you're just hanging out with peers that happen to have these stories. And so it definitely hits in a different way and you're able to reflect on that. And then you have someone to think about and to keep in mind when and contextualize everything else that I already knew.
It's a learning journey, one that Coralia remains on as she navigates living on stolen land and making a home for herself in a country that's pushed people out of theirs, a country she was born in. Children of immigrants, first-generation Canadians, second-generation immigrants, almost 3 in 10 children fall into this category, with that number expected to grow quickly over the next decade. The experience of being born in Canada to parents who gave up everything to immigrate here is complex and unique. It changes the way you see and navigate life here in Canada. It's an experience that everyone might not understand. And as a child of immigrants myself, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to make this series. I'm Karina Zapata, and you're listening to The Second Gen, a series focused on the stories of children of immigrants in Canada. This project is powered by Shaw and made possible with the Community Podcast Initiative on the traditional territories of the Blackfoot Confederacy and the people of the Treaty 7 region in southern Alberta, the Siksika, Piikani, Kainai, Tsuut'ina, and Îyâhe Nakoda, as well as the Métis people. In this episode, we'll focus on living on stolen land and how children of immigrants navigate the fact that they're inherently benefiting from colonialism on the land that they were born on. For this conversation, Coralia and I connected virtually with Gabby Aquino in Scarborough, Ontario. We were also joined by Jessica Pakunayan in Yellowknife, Northwest Territories.
So my name is Gabby Aquino, she, her pronouns. My parents immigrated from the Philippines. Both sides of the family are specifically from the Ilocos regions. And I was born and raised in Scarborough, currently living in Toronto, both of which are in the Williams Treaties and the Treaty 13 territories.
Hi, I'm Coralia. My pronouns are she, her. My family immigrated from Nicaragua. I was born in Winnipeg, which is Treaty 3, and I currently live and located in Mokensis, otherwise known as Calgary, Treaty 7.
So my name is Jessica Pakunayan, she, her pronouns, Philippines are where my parents are from, and I currently live in Sambaque, which is Chief Dragi's territory, so Yellowknife, Northwest Territories.
Okay, so Gabby, let's start with you. So I guess, when did you first learn and start to understand the fact that you live on stolen land?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think I had any one sort of particular pinpoint moment. I think a lot of it, interestingly enough, I grew up in the Catholic education system. And I think at the time, some of my teachers, because Scarborough is a very racially diverse community, they made their own sort of efforts to try and push us to recognize some of those colonial parts of Canada's history. And so I think high school was one of the earliest times that I could remember where we were specifically taught about residential schools. And I think as minuscule as that sort of learning was, it was still something that kind of, in many ways, pushed me to try and learn a bit more. Because at the time I was also, I think growing up, my parents always taught us a bit about Philippine history and some of the colonization and imperialism we've experienced at the hands of the Spanish and then the Americans and then the Japanese. So I think learning about colonization in Canada was also a way to better understand my family's own history and who I was as well. So yeah, I think those were some of the beginnings of that learning or unlearning.
I want to go into all of that a little bit later on. I think that's really important to chat about. Coralia, I know that you live in Calgary now, but you were born in Winnipeg. Was that situation different for you? I guess, when did you start to kind of learn and understand that you live on stolen land?
I think that's a complex question in the sense that I think it was unraveled. Like, I don't think there was just like a specific moment where like, aha, like this is when I realized that we were on stolen land or colonized territories, because I think as an immigrant, we know that we're on borrowed land, if that makes sense. And so right away, you know that this isn't yours. So there is kind of that sense of, it may not belong to me, but it belongs to someone. And there's a certain group of people that runs this place. So there's that discomfort and awareness that like things aren't quite right, I think. And you kind of get to realize really quickly when you're different, like who's the majority and who kind of runs the show, I suppose. But growing up in Winnipeg, I have a different sense of the land compared to when I came to Calgary. I grew up in an elementary school with an elder in our library, and they were usually the person that helped us choose our books. And so I had a lot of exposure to, I guess, European culture and the Indigenous culture in Canada, and it was kind of held to the same level. And so I don't think I had a huge awareness of like how negative things were until I left that bubble and kind of came to other regions where it was very clear cut that Indigenous cultures weren't as respected as my little elementary school culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really interesting because, you know, you were born in Canada, but it's true, like with immigrant parents, that is your first understanding of how these things work. Like you go to school, but really that's where you get your understanding. So that's really interesting. Jess, what about you? You live in Yellowknife now, but you grew up in Calgary. So what was the situation like for you?
So growing up in Calgary, I didn't have too much exposure. I learned about Indigenous people in Alberta, but I didn't, you know, like some of the history, but not too much about like residential schools. I think it was only until I moved up to Yellowknife where we have, I think, one of the highest populations of residential school survivors that you recognize and see, you know, what residential school has done to the people, the culture, the way of life, the changes that they have to, you know,
go through, endure. And so really it's just, yeah, like, you know, you guys have said it. It was over time that you're like, oh yeah, this is actually worse than I thought. It's good to know about. It's just, yeah, quite surprising and quite a lot to process. Because there's just, yeah, you just don't know what's going on. You don't know how you should behave, how you should interact with others, how that changes your relationships with, like, your coworkers. And for me, since I do work with a lot of Indigenous coworkers, it's like night and day. Like our home lives, our work lives, how we're treated. So it's just like a very weird in between.
Yeah, that's a really good way to describe it. I relate to all of you on this one. I think all of our experiences are like pretty similar here, where for me, like, I remember learning about Indigenous people and residential schools and everything they had gone through when I was still fairly young. And for me, I don't know if it's the same for you all, but it was kind of like, you have an understanding of how things are, you kind of accept it. And then as I grew older, I realized, like, whoa, this is really not okay. Like, I didn't understand the gravity of the situation. And it was exactly like Jess said, where it was really surprising, like that realization of, like, I had known this for so long, but I had never really understood it. Like, that was really surprising to me. And I was way older when I just, like, truly just started to understand what it meant and how I benefited from colonialism as a child of immigrants, as someone who lives on stolen colonized land. So Jess, I want to go back to you. Now that you're an adult, what is it like for you to navigate the idea that you live on colonized land and benefit from colonialism?
I mean, as an adult, sure, it feels like I have a lot more power and agency to make wiser choices and like support others, locals, you know, financially, that kind of thing, or advocate, you know, where I can, either at work, social media, whatever, or like be able to talk to my friends about my experiences, those kinds of things, because what I noticed as an adult too, is that like other, you know, friends that I grew up with in Calgary don't have the same exposure to Indigenous cultures and Indigenous ways of life. And so it's an absolute privilege to be able to have that experience and to share it with others as well. So, you know, they're aware of what's going on, what others are feeling or, you know, are going through. Like, we have prayers every single morning before we start work during our team meetings. And my manager, who is Indigenous, she's like, oh, Jess, like, you should say a Filipino prayer. And I was like, I don't even speak my own language. This is so sad. Like, I'm, like, Googling, like, Tagalog Lord's Prayer and like trying to say it. It was so embarrassing. But, you know, one thing I've learned from like the Indigenous folks is that, you know, language is obviously very important, but they remind me too that, you know, where my parents came from, their language is important as well. And so, yeah, it's kind of this like relationship of encouraging each other to be in touch with the land, with your culture, with your people, that kind of thing. And so, yeah, as an adult, it's great. It feels like you have a lot more power.
Gabby, going to you, what was that learning journey like for you, I guess, now that you're an adult?
Yeah, that's a really big question. I don't even know where to begin. I think there's, or at least what that makes me think about is it's really shifted my understanding of solidarity. I think in sort of learning or recognizing that my home is on someone else's home, and by virtue of who and where I am, I benefit from colonization, that sort of gave me the language, the lenses, and some of the understandings to, I guess, connect the dots and realize and recognize what's happening here in terms of the colonial processes, the value systems that underlie those processes, and the structures that those processes create and who it benefits is visible in other colonized contexts, whether we're talking about the Philippines, Nicaragua, or like all over the world, essentially. And I think that really pushed me to recognize how advocating for things like land back, indigenous sovereignty, and decolonization in all its facets at every sort of possible opportunity in your professional, personal, and other capacities is something that is, like, everyone has a stake in it. What that looks like, I think, is different for different people, depending on, you know, where they're coming from and what their positionality is. But I think at the end of the day, I think a lot of that unlearning process sort of continues to show me how much, how much no one is truly free and until we all are, and how much you really do have to, like, one community struggle in so many ways is also yours. And a lot of your own struggles are also theirs. And so I think what that's also taught me is just how important relationships also are, and how relational solidarity and trying to build other futures that are decolonized, that don't have things like borders and so on, are really about the relationships that we have with everyone and everything around us.
Coralia, what about you? I guess what has that journey been like for you?
Yeah, I think as an adult or a teenager, it's kind of like part two of the whole, and contextualizing a little bit more of my childhood and realizing what was happening in my childhood. My father working in Churchill and him coming back with stories about what was happening in Churchill, Manitoba. One of the particular instances that I like never forget, or stories that he shared with me, was when like a minor was pregnant and she was identified as indigenous, and she was, my father figured out like she can't have the pregnancy here. She has to be flown to Winnipeg. Otherwise the pregnancy might not go well and neither the baby nor the patient could make it. And so my father was like, okay, we got to call the helicopter and we got to get her out of here. And the staff was there like, okay, Dr. Sevilla, that's going to cost $2,000. He was like, okay, cool. Like they just thought they were saying that in passing. And they're like, no, you don't realize that's going to cost money. And it was just very clear cut in that moment for him that they were like, oh, it's the money over the value of that person's life. And he came back with many stories in that regard. And I think luckily from a very early age, because he shared those experiences for me, that it was just very obvious that there were differences. And I could tell that my family was rather protective of the Indigenous people that we did come in contact with and became close friends with. And it's something that I didn't totally understand as a kid, because I didn't have explicit conversations with my parents of like, why do you feel so protective of the Indigenous communities here? Like, why do we take them in our home in such a special way? Like, not that I'm bothered, but I was just like, okay, I guess this is just what my parents do, and just kind of went with the flow. And it wasn't until like being an adult and being able to like ask them questions of like, why did you feel that way? Or why did you do that? And their response is generally like, well, that's what you do for anyone, but also particularly those that are being hurt more specifically, you know, like, and my dad will say jokingly, there are brothers and sisters, we look alike, in the sense that, people from Nicaragua are often mestizo, so being Spanish, European, and indigenous people of those lands. And so he doesn't see those differences in the same way I guess traditionally most Canadians or maybe different immigrants might see themselves. But yeah, as an adult, just being able to more heavily contextualize my childhood, but then as an adult, I'm more actively in control of who I surround myself with, what I guess how I process information. And I think more and more as an adult, I find myself how my community and my surroundings have changed, and I'm more involved, and we help each other heal, vice versa, with our immigrant experience and themselves with their experiences regarding residential schools and how they are treated, and we learn from each other.
So I have a question for you all. So we'll kind of just go around, but let's start with Karalia. So I guess as a child of immigrants, what would you say our role is, your role is in Truth and Reconciliation?
What do we do and what our passions are in life kind of, I think, will narrate a little bit how we embrace that Truth and Reconciliation. For myself, I'm a school teacher, and I'm also a climber. Like, those are the two big activities that I engage in. And so from a teaching perspective, my role is to make sure that my students are informed of their own heritage. I teach in the Northeast, so most of my students are mostly Punjabi and Sikh. And so for me, there's an importance for them to use their power and use their knowledge of their culture and have an understanding of that, you know, and kind of connect to them on that level before I also toss in, okay, Canada's Indigenous history and all that, because I don't need them acclimatizing to our culture like so heavily the way that we probably would have, if that makes sense. Because they are who they are, and they're in a community where they can embrace different cultures. And so for me, it's that weaving things as naturally and as authentically as possible, you know. And one of the beautiful things was, like, on Truth and Reconciliation Day, or the day before, we talked to our kids and throughout the week about what's going on and the meaning of that day. And those kids are in grade 4, and they can tell you exactly what a residential school is, why those things are harmful, what went wrong, and, like, kind of what our responsibilities are. And that's, like, a huge thing to see. The trickier part is more dismantling those, like, systematic things that still exist. That, you know, just have Truth and Reconciliation Day as sort of like, we're still on a very surface level acknowledgement of all these things and breaking down the system. You know, part of my Truth and Reconciliation is being straightforward about the things that I don't understand, and being more purposeful moving forward. You know, I think one of the trickier things for me right now is just being like, Indigenous culture, when there is so much individuality between, like, Cree nations and Métis nation and Blackfoot nations and the different nations that are in my area, and the diversity of every culture and every nation and what they bring to the table.
Jess, I want to go to you. Same question for you. What do you think your role is, our role is as children of immigrants, in Truth and Reconciliation?
I guess, so for me, I work with the Klingchong government, and so they're one of the few Indigenous groups that was able to start a modern treaty with Canada, a new lands claim agreement, and set up their own government from it. And so I'm very privileged to be able to get exposed to, you know, various perspectives, and to work with so many people who are advocating for, you know, protection of their land and resources. I think one thing that I've learned is that, at least right now, we're still in a process of gaining trust from outsiders, trust from, like, exploration companies, you know, government. You know, when white people tell us how we're supposed to manage our land, water, resources, caribou, I think just that it's going to take a lot of time and listening, and it won't be our clock or our time to say, okay, now we've, like, reconciled, or we can move past this now. It'll be completely up to, you know, the Indigenous folks and whatever their time is to be able to, for all of us as Canadians, to reestablish, you know, Truth and Reconciliation.
And Gabby, I'm going to finish off with you. What would you say your role is, our role is, in Truth and Reconciliation?
Yeah, I feel like there's no sort of one linear single answer. I think I'm also struggling with the idea of, like, what it even means to be children of immigrants, because we are so diverse. And I think there's also people who might otherwise be understood as children of immigrants who don't necessarily see themselves as that. And I guess what I'm specifically thinking about is folks whose ancestors were stolen from their homelands and then forcibly brought to other homelands, and then down the line, later generations immigrated to a place like Canada. So I think, yeah, I guess all that to say that, one, there's no sort of one single answer. And then two, I think we also might have to unpack how we understand immigration itself, and who falls in that category, if we even want to keep that category, and just even the thinking of putting people and things in categories as well. But I think the other sort of big thing that comes to mind is also that I think a lot of it is I can't help but think about like relationship building, really understanding like whose lands you live on, what that means, what specific histories you might be entangled in, and what responsibilities come out of those histories and the continuance of those histories. And I think it also involves a constant renegotiation. I think that things can change over time. So how we respond to truth and reconciliation also changes over time, and also results in evolving responsibilities. And I think, another thing that it's also making me think about is, I remember I had a professor say when I was in law school and I was doing an intensive or a clinic that related to like Aboriginal law and unpacking or trying to learn about and understand Indigenous legal traditions. Everyone has different gifts, right? So I think that it goes back to the original point of it's different for everyone. But I think that's to say that like everyone has a role in this. And I guess my mind is going there because I feel like a lot of communities who have migrated here, including the ones I belong to, really struggle with settler guilt and really struggle with even like confronting the concept of living on stolen land. So in doing that, I think they neglect not only the responsibilities, but the gifts that they have and that they can bring to the conversation and to the process of reconciliation, decolonization, and land back.
I think something to touch on a little bit from what Gabby was saying is sort of like, yeah, like to analyze who we are and our identities is kind of like tricky and what our roles are, especially because I think what's kind of interesting about this whole fact is that as immigrants or as settlers or visitors, we are more actively looking at our identities and our roles automatically due to our experiences, but our white peers or peers that have been here for multiple generations and are a little bit further removed from their immigration don't look at themselves or don't analyze their situation or their privilege as much. So I think it is sometimes a little bit sticky where it's like, okay, should we as immigrants really be looking at this as heavily as like some other people that could be stronger allies with less weight on their shoulders than we already have? Like, we also have our very distinct intergenerational traumas of our own. And then to step into someone else's, it's tough because it is re-traumatizing to us too, you know, despite these traumas being different and of course needing to be acknowledged separately because of the land that we're on. It is also hard for us to participate in these things when they do bring up quite intricate parts of our lives as well. I do wish and ask that people that have less of that weight on their shoulders would stand up a little bit more. Like sometimes when I speak to my white friends or colleagues, they're like, oh, this just feels so overwhelming. And it always reminds me of that sort of privilege that others have in terms of like, oh, for you, this diversity and inclusion sort of trend, as it may seem to some people, is a privilege for you to be exhausted with. Like, you, some people are allowed to feel tired, allowed to set this aside for a moment. we can remove ourselves as much as we can, but unfortunately, our faces and our culture and the way we eat and what we bring to lunch, you know, starts questions, and automatically we're still brought right back into things. You know, there isn't a way for us to hide as much as others in terms of like what we feel and what our opinions are on certain things. So I think a big thing for me is I used to hold on to a lot of anger when it came to like explaining these different things to people who don't have as much maybe cultural empathy, or that like, I need you to hear me as much as possible, and I need you to use your voice, and when I ask you to use it, like, use it, you know? So I think as much as what we can do is call on others, because I think a lot of us, you know, are in a position of a very intricate type of fatigue because of our own cultures as well, you know?
The other thing I also want to add too is in thinking about, okay, what are the roles of like so-called immigrants in Truth and Reconciliation? I think we also kind of have to like globalize our understanding of Truth and Reconciliation and understand how settler colonialism in Canada has direct reaches internationally, including the places we come from. And there are also ways in which the places we come from contribute to settler colonialism here. Like a very quick example is just how much, or how, I guess, immigration to places like Canada and the US and the Philippines is seen as like this profitable enterprise. And so the government, in like really explicit ways, has pushed and even depended on people to migrate and to live on other people's homes in order to sustain itself. And I think for folks who are now here in places like Canada, part of our role is also kind of disrupting those connections and trying to think about the other ways that settler colonialism rears its head in those other contexts, and how we can, I think we also have a responsibility to think of, or I guess dismantle settler colonialism here in ways that dismantle colonialism and other systemic oppressions back home, wherever home is, because all those things in so many ways touch each other and are like interdependent and interconnected. So yeah, I think that's another really big piece that I feel really falls on the shoulders of folks who have migrated here.
That was Coralia Sevilla, Jessica Pakunayan, and Gabby Aquino on Living on Stolen Land and how learning about Indigenous history and culture helped them better understand the history of their people as children of immigrants. I'm Karina Zapata, and this is The Second Gen. Thanks for listening. And be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to hear our other episodes on heritage languages and expectations of success. This project is made possible with the Community Podcast Initiative and powered by Shaw. You can learn more about the Community Podcast Initiative at thepodcaststudio.ca.